This is Jewish Board Talk with Cherise Zifford, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Professor Barry Shubb is an internationally renowned virologist whose achievement and contributions to virology and infectious disease saw him being awarded the Order of the Mapungubwe. He became a household name in our community during the COVID pandemic with his up-to-date knowledge and sage advice. During this time, he chaired the Ministerial Advisory Committee on COVID Vaccines. Professor Shubb has in fact served on numerous local and international associations, and he was the founding director of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, the NICD, serving as its executive director between 2002 and 2011. And now he has just published a book on the history of the NICD entitled Fighting an Invisible Enemy, the Story of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases. Prof. Shubb, welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Cherise. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Prof, why did you write the book?
Cherise, I think there are a couple of reasons. It really started off from Professor Jack Metz, who is the director of the South African Institute of Medical Research, the SIMR. He wrote a book on the history of the SIMR, and that really kicked it off. And he strongly urged me to also write a history of the NICD. So I really started as a historical book to document the NICD. And then as I was writing it, there were a lot of kind of, I think, very entertaining, very palatable for an average reader, for the general reader to read, stories from the NICD, as the NICD was being formed and as the NICD is functioning today. So I thought it'd make a very good read. And then lastly, I think it also is a document which I think people can learn from, people that are involved in public health, people that set up these kind of institutions, to learn from what the NICD has gone through, the pros, the cons, the highs and the lows, and so on.
Why was it started? Why did you start it, I should say?
Those are two separate questions. It really started, in fact, with Professor James Gere, one of my mentors, with just looking at polio, at poliomyelitis. And it started with what was called the Poliomyelitis Research Foundation. That started in the mid-1950s, it started in 1953, until 1976. 1976, it was taken over by the government. Before that, it was an NGO. And then it became the National Institute for Virology, directly under the government. I came in, it was 1976, I came in September. I was the deputy director then. In 1982, I became the director of the NIV. And then in 1995, I actually penned a letter to the deputy director general of health and the director general of health. I said, look, you know, we really need an institute of communicable diseases. And all the bricks were there ready. There was the NIV for virology, which is a large chunk of infectious diseases. And the SIMR had a very good microbiology, which was the rest of the communicable disease. I said, why don't we just put these two together and we'll have a lovely communicable disease? Well, it took 3 years or 4 years. And I think what really kind of allowed the NICD to come into being was the formation of the National Health Laboratory Service, which is really part of the ANC's health plan. So when the ANC came into government in 1995, they had other things to deal with then, but towards the end of that decade, I sat with Nicholas Crisp, who's now the Deputy Director General. I think he's a well-known person with regard to NHR. I won't go there, but anyway. Nicholas and I sat for over 6 months. He moved in, actually, to the campus of the NICD, and we planned the NHLS and the NICD. And it came into being, what, in 2002? That was when it was officially launched.
Wow, it's incredible to think of the history and also the role it plays in combating viruses and pandemics.
Yeah.
And, I mean, COVID took us all, I think, by surprise.
It took everybody by surprise, including us in the field.
and kind of, did you think, I mean, because I know you do a lot of research around all kinds of things there, including malaria and TB and things like that.
Right.
Did you imagine that a virus like COVID would again strike?
I think, you know, Cherise, COVID, I think, first of all, it took us all by surprise internationally, and I think we were really caught unprepared, to be quite honest. I think the global biomedical community was taken by surprise. I think we learned a lot of lessons from it. I think we'll be a lot better prepared for the next pandemic. And I think, you know, it should have been predicted, because there are certainly the signs are there. The virus causing COVID, a related virus, you know, the virus causing COVID is SARS-CoV-2. SARS-CoV-1 appeared in 2003, and that should have alerted us that this group of viruses called the coronaviruses would come back to haunt us. And gosh, it really came back to haunt us.
And with all the focus on COVID, we forget the role that HIV/AIDS played in our society and continues to play. And we hardly talk about HIV/AIDS. Why is that?
Well, HIV really is one of the kind of big research fields which still have to get a usable vaccine against HIV. And it's amazing, it took 11 months to get a usable vaccine for COVID. HIV has been going now since 1983, the virus was first isolated, and we still don't have a vaccine.
Why is that?
I think there are a number of reasons. It's a very complex, it's a very simple virus in its structure and a very complex virus in its function. Hmm. It's part of the immune system, so it undermines the immune system, which is really what you use to make vaccines. So it's very concealed. Hmm. And also, it is the most changeable virus of all.
Sure.
It's the most, what we call, mutable or changeable virus. And that makes it very, very complex to try and design a vaccine. This is one of the kind of biggest. In fact, it's the biggest research unit at the NICD, is the HIV research unit, which mainly focuses on designing, on developing a HIV vaccine. And it's part of the international, what's called the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, which looks at putative and candidate vaccines.
Hmm. You've mentioned polio, you've mentioned HIV, and we've obviously spoken about COVID.
Right.
And I attended your book launch at Exclusive Books, which was a fantastic event.
Thank you.
And the discussions around denialism and anti-vaxxers. And my question to you is, does every pandemic have the same trajectory, only in terms of how it's received and how it's dealt with?
Yeah, I think, Sharice, you've touched on an extremely important point, and that is the role, you're talking about the anti-vaxxers and so on, the role of the community, of the population, of the public. They play an absolutely crucial role in controlling these pandemics. You know, if we look way back on the smallpox, you don't have smallpox anymore because there was an efficient vaccine and a good public health campaign and so on. And there was also community buy-in.
So when was smallpox?
Smallpox, well, it's one of the most ancient diseases.
Right.
So it's been right the back, you know, see it on Egyptian mummies and so on. But the smallpox eradication campaign started in the late 1960s, 1967. And that launched, and it took 10 years to eradicate smallpox. Now, polio started off in 1988. The WHO launched its polio eradication campaign. Now, in smallpox, there was public buy-in, and the public helped, and the public communicated, and the public were part of the campaign. So polio is another story, and it's a different population. And now we don't have public buy-in from various parts of the world where there is strife. The smallpox campaign, they actually had what they call days of tranquility, where they actually stopped the civil war to allow the immunization campaign to go in. Polio, we got the opposite. In various parts, and particularly northern Nigeria and Afghanistan and Pakistan, there's been a lot of resistance to the vaccination, to the extent that the polio vaccinators, several dozen of them have been murdered by extremists. So we've got the opposite, and this is why, frustratingly, we cannot get to that end point of polio eradication. We're almost there, almost there. There are only a handful of polio cases left in the world, but we're not quite there yet. And the deadline, the original deadline, was the year 2000, then to 2005 and so on and so forth.
So what is the kind of mentality of the anti-vaxxers? And it's not just vaccinations. I mean, I think of the discussion that was held around President Mbeki and denialism, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Do the two go hand in hand?
They do. And unfortunately, it's not a lack of support, it's anti-support. It's a campaign against vaccination. Why is it? I think it's a complex question, and there are a lot of complex answers. But what certainly kind of fuels it is the social media. Mm. In fact, the WHO have coined a term, they call it the infodemic, the information epidemic. And this is a major, major barrier to public health generally and specifically to vaccination campaigns.
I mean, it's interesting in that the smallpox was easier to eradicate when you would imagine people would have been less sophisticated in terms of medical awareness compared to today.
Right.
And yet it's the exact opposite.
Yeah, look, I think smallpox had a lot going for it. You know, it's a very visible disease, so it's very easy to kind of track. You could even track who's been vaccinated because you had the scar in the arm. Polio, much more difficult because only 1% of people that get polio get the clinical symptom of what we call flaccid paralysis, which is used to track the disease. And of course, the epidemiological tracking is critical to the control. So it was an easier disease to eradicate. But having said that, we still the problem is that the public were much more amenable because it was a more visible, disfiguring disease. Polio, well, it also caused a lot of kind of panic, a lot of kind of horror in the population. But the population didn't buy into the same extent, unfortunately.
That's fascinating. Then my question is, we've just got mpox now as well.
Yeah.
Do all viruses have the same trajectory in and of themselves? I mean, you're talking about HIV is more mutable, it's internal.
Yeah.
I mean, are they all potentially able to be eradicated?
No, only those viruses which have got a control mechanism like vaccination can be eradicated. And also, there's a second requirement, and that's that the virus is only limited to humans. Because once you've got a reservoir in the animal kingdom, you've always got a reservoir which can come back again.
So would that be HIV?
HIV is exclusive to humans, correct? And as was smallpox, as is polio, as is measles, as is mumps and rubella, and all of them.
So what would be an example of one where animals?
The viral hemorrhagic fevers is one of them. The arbovirus, you know, the
lots of them.
But the main ones are human viruses. And this is the problem, of course, that the great majority, 70 to 80% of new infections, big new virus infections, come from the animal kingdom because we encroach on that ecosystem by trading with exotic animals, by deforestation, going into the environment where humans don't normally come into interaction with humans. And that's probably where COVID came from. It came from the animal kingdom. It leapt across that species barrier and infected humans, as did HIV, in fact.
Yes.
HIV came probably originally from primates.
Yes.
Going all the way back to about the 1930s.
Sure.
And there's a way that one can molecularly, it's called a molecular clock, we can actually trace when that leap occurred. And this is one of the problems, because trading exploiting animals and going into the ecosystem with deforestation, agricultural expansion, all these kind of things make us a lot more vulnerable. Then we've got international travel, which is going to spread more rapidly.
Yes, I mean, I remember that with COVID, how quickly it went. But COVID also went to animals.
Yes.
Animals also...
It does go the other way down as well. Animals can be infected with human cells, SARS-CoV-2, with human COVID virus, yes.
But do you ever see kind of like, I mean, how do viruses evolve themselves?
Yeah, viruses keep on changing. They're very, very simple. They're bits of genetic material. And because they're very simple, they can change very rapidly. And many of them do.
So, which brings us back to the NICD and its role in our society.
As epidemiological surveillance to kind of keep tabs on it.
And the institute that you've built and mentored, continue to mentor, what role do you see it having in terms of continuing in fighting viruses?
It's got a national role, being the National Institute for Communicable Diseases. It's also got an international role. In fact, there are 11 reference laboratories of the WHO cited in the NICD. So it's not only laboratories, it's also the epidemiology, the surveillance, and analyzing of diseases. And it is it's a prominent international institution, and it's kind of earned its wings in the international sphere.
So you feel very proud of it.
I do, as the father of it. I feel very proud of it indeed.
And the book. Back to the book.
Right.
Where can you get it, and how can you get it?
Oh, it's really available through many of the bookshops and also the online from Takealot and Loot and Amazon and Barnes and Noble. They're all doing stocking there.
Last question, very quickly, in like 20 seconds, is there any story that sticks out in your book that you would like to share?
Oh, gosh, there are so many of them. Any particular story? Wow, that's a difficult one. I think you caught me on the wrong foot.
Shall we leave it to the audience, to the listeners, to buy?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Charisse. You rescued me.
That was Professor Barry Shove, and he has just launched his book, The History of the NICD, Fighting an Invisible Enemy, The Story of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.